Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Theodore Adorno and the culture industry.
Aren't the cultural products of capitalism bound to be pure crap?
You are literally pop culture illiterate.
I have a college degree. My pop culture references are Hamlet, Achilles, and Dorian Gray. Ever heard of any of them?
Sam, you really need to be educated.
It's understood that Hollywood sells Californication.
Doesn't capitalism produce cultural products that are exploitative and manipulative?
Murder, crime, poverty, these things don't concern me. Concerns me. Celebrity magazines, television with 500 channels, some guy's name on my underwear.
Our guest is Adrian Daub from Stanford University.
Co-author of the James Bond songs, Pop Anthems of Late Capitalism.
Adorno and the Culture Industry.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again. We need it now, the fierce urgency of donating now.
So here's what you can do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thanks for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you so much for donating.
Is popular culture just a way for capitalism to breed conformity?
Or does the market give us exactly the art we desire?
When money does the talking, does original art even stand a chance?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KLW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about Adorno, Theodore Adorno, that is, and the culture industry.
Industry? Culture? Ken, culture's not an industry. Culture's made by people.
Josh, you surprise me. You have such a quaint vision. Well, you think culture is made by, like, hipsters in artist colonies or individual creators toiling away in obscurity or something like that?
Well, that's certainly part of the picture.
A teeny tiny part, Josh. Come on. Culture is big business these days. I mean, think of compare it to a conveyor belt in a Ford factory. You know, that factory turns out millions of cars, each one's more or less identical. And that's exactly how Hollywood works. It's a factory too, Josh. It turns out zillions and zillions of films, each one more or less identical, give or take a star or a scenery or a little plot twist.
So Blade Runner is the same as Citizen Kane, Seventh Seal. Is identical to When Harry Met Sally?
Different paint job, same engine, Josh. And you know what the engine is. It's capitalism. Oh. It's just like Adorno says. All these big budget movies celebrate the system that makes them possible. They present life under capitalism as a paradise, a wonderful world where the system takes care of everyone. Marx got it wrong. It's not religion. It's movies that are the opium of the people, Josh.
You sound like a conspiracy theorist, Ken. Where's your tinfoil hat, dude?
Well, I see they've gone to you, too, Josh. You've been watching too many of those movies. Which ones have you been watching?
I don't know. How about Requiem for a Dream or 12 Years a Slave? I mean, there's plenty of movies out there that don't present life as a paradise.
That's because the capitalists are clever. Those movies just show, they're designed to show, that resistance is futile. That's what Adorno would say. They make us feel like there's no hope, no point fighting back. They make us resigned to the capitalist system.
Sounds like your friend Adorno wants to have it both ways. I mean, you know, all movies show people getting the help they need, except for the ones that don't.
That's called dialectical thinking, Josh. You know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That's what it is.
Yeah, I have a different word for it, Ken, but maybe I won't use it on the radio.
Oh, please don't.
Look, there's tons of art out there that isn't about conformity and it isn't about futility. It's about resistance. So think about, I don't know, the music of Annie DeFranco or that great film you and I both love, Get Out.
Josh, you're not seeing the comprehensiveness of the system. It's like Adorno says, look, the content of something can parade as countercultural, but if the form is conventional, it just reinforces the status quo. Look, to really wake people up from their consumerist slumbers, you have to be transgressive, truly transgressive. Revolutionary art requires revolutionary forms, Josh.
But there's plenty of revolutionary forms even now. I mean, think of the movies of Spike Lee or punk or hip hop go back to Adorno's period and think about jazz, right? I mean, when these forms first hit the scene, they were revolutionary, innovative, transgressive. Even though they were produced under the same capitalist system you keep talking about.
Look, I'm going to concede to you a tiny bit that Adorno maybe exaggerates a tiny little bit.
Oh, you could say that again.
No, but he's getting at the truth, a profound truth. When art is commodified, when it needs to make money, it's bound to sell out. It has to. I mean, think of all those crappy sequels, Rocky 74 or something like that. Think product placement. Come on.
Look, it's not that different, Ken, from how it's always been. I mean, don't forget all the art that was made for monarchs or for the church. Don't forget Shakespeare pandering to the groundlings. Look, there's always been patrons and there's always been audiences to please. But here's the thing. People still manage to produce great art.
You're just missing it, Josh. Look, I agree that art can be produced in many different eras and all that sort of stuff, but in capitalism, art is a mere commodity. That's all it is. It's designed to make money and nothing more. We've lost the sense that art is something radically free, something valuable for its own sake and not just for the money it can make. It's not just a commodity. We've lost art that shows us even the possibility that we can have a different world, a world that's not so rapacious. Come on, Josh.
I mean, that I agree with you on. I think we really do need a space like that, showing us a vision of a different kind of world. All I'm saying is, we still have it, right? I'm not saying today's system is perfect. I'm just saying it's also given us some really great art.
I see it's going to take some work to convince you from your commodified capitalist slumber, Josh. And maybe our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, can help. We sent her to find out more about what was driving Adorno to these fascinating ideas and how they resonate in today's pop culture. She files this report.
When Theodor Adorno was living in exile in the United States in the late 30s and early 40s, he must have been jarred by pop culture's failure to reckon with the war back in Europe. The most popular movies at the time glorified Americans' role in the war, like the hit Wake Island.
They didn't have enough weapons. They didn't have enough men. All they had were guts and each other.
Pop culture offers an escape from powerlessness when we need it. To Adorno, that's part of what made it a problem. It also gives us a chance to confront power when that's what we need. When we watch Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, we get to make a mockery of the Hitler figure, heard here giving a speech followed by a translator.
We must tighten our belts.
His Excellency has just referred to the Jewish people.
In this imaginary space, viewers get to belittle the great dictator.
Kill off the Jews, wipe out the brunettes. Then will come forth our dream, a pure Aryan race.
Beautiful blonde Aryans.
They will love you, they will adore you. They will worship you as a god.
No, you mustn't say it. You make me afraid of myself.
At this point in the movie, the dictator has climbed up the curtains in fright.
Leave me. I want to be alone.
For Adorno, this vicarious experience replaces the real experience of living under power. Rebellion is given vent. Today, when we listen to Trevor Noah cleverly make a fool of Donald Trump, it feels like consolation that at least we're on the right team.
Once you realize that Trump is basically the perfect African president, you start to notice the similarities everywhere.
I'm really rich.
I have a great temperament.
They love me anyway. I don't have to do this.
The people like me very much. I am very popular. I am very powerful. I am the one who has got the money.
These feel like battles we're winning. But Adorno would point out that the real winner is what he calls the culture industry. TV, magazines, movies, the whole business behind culture. CNN executive John Martin predicted a Trump win would be, quote, a bit better from a business standpoint, explaining there would be a, quote, general fascination that wouldn't be the same under a Clinton administration. But can something be good for the culture industry and social progress at the same time? The past 2 years have shown us that being woke definitely sells. see pretty much any of the Super Bowl commercials.
When disaster strikes to one, we all get together and support each other. That's the nature of humanity. I'll stand
by you. That one's for Mass Mutual Insurance. This next one's for Ram Trucks with the voice of Martin Luther King.
You don't have to know the second theory of thermodynamics in physics to serve.
You only need a heart full of grace.
The mainstreaming of wokeness has also been a boon to the newest subset of the culture industry, social media. Like this genre of viral video.
An ally is a person that wants to fight for the equality of a marginalized group that they're not a part of. We need your help building this house, but you probably should listen so you know what to do first. Let's do this.
It's hard to parse which of our experiences online carry over to the rest of our lives. Adorno wrote that, quote, on all sides, the borderline between culture and empirical reality becomes more and more indistinct. The fact that Trump is a reality TV star is a merciless twist on that thought, and his spectacles have real empirical consequences.
If it weren't for me, you wouldn't even be talking about illegal immigration, Chris. You wouldn't even be talking about it.
Adorno wrote about the many kinds of deception it takes to get people to support a political program that, as he wrote, is largely incompatible with their own rational self-interest. He was writing about capitalism. In his framework, the culture industry is there to do whatever capitalism needs it to do to make us okay with capitalism. Right now, a sense of momentum towards social justice is something people are willing to pay for. The box office-busting Black Panther is part of that.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
The revolution will be live.
In the pop culture space at least, it feels like progress. That's why it's so unsettling to learn things like this. In terms of wealth, things are getting worse for Black and Latino people in this country. One prediction is that by 2053, median wealth for Black and Latino people will be zero. Actually, poor people of all races are getting poorer while rich people get richer. It's sickening to contemplate. It makes you want to watch a movie about vanquishing the rich.
We're starting a people's uprising. Do you fancy joining us?
That would make me feel better.
Yes, I'd love to. We own now.
We own now. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that fascinating tour of Trump wokeness and Mutual of Omaha, Liza. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're asking about Adorno and the culture industry.
We're joined now by Adrian Daub, professor of German and Comp-Lit at Stanford University and co-author of the James Bond songs, Pop Anthems of Late Capitalism. Adrian, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So, Adrian, how did you get first interested in the culture industry and Adorno and all that stuff? Were you like in a punk band that sold out or what?
I wish. I by my training is all about high culture and about art from the 19th century, but I've always written on pop culture. And I love pop culture. I'm an avid consumer of it. At the same time, I find myself really worried when people sort of hold up the latest TV show, the latest pop song, as you know, equivalent to artworks or doing pretty much the same thing. And they don't seem the same to me. I love both, but they don't seem the same to me.
Okay, so that brings me to the big argument that Ken and I were having a moment ago. So, you know, Ken was saying a culture, including especially pop culture, has gotten worse under capitalism. I was saying, well, it's not that different, really, from how it's been in the past. Where do you stand on that? Is everything swirling down the toilet, or is it much the same as it's ever been?
I hate to tell you that I agree with Ken on this one. I think that there is something about the capitalist system of production when it's applied to culture that, if not necessarily wrecks art, distends it, right? The fact that it's produced for consumers and is who need sort of recognizable forms, genres, and narratives can make it less interesting, yeah.
So you're saying that people in the Middle Ages didn't like to listen to recognizable forms and it was every artwork was radically different from every other artwork or something like that?
Well, they had certainly less choice, right? And they were exposed to things that they sort of needed to figure out as sort of a given. They were not consumers in that sense. You can't walk into one Gothic cathedral and say, I don't like this one, I'm going to go to the next one.
Yeah, in the Gothic cathedral, there's lots of art in a Gothic cathedral. cathedral. And as I understand it, it's meant to give you that feeling of transcendence. It's meant to kind of whoosh you up toward the heavens. It's meant to inspire you. It's not meant to, like, titillate you.
But this is, I think, the real nub of the issue here, right? That the assumption seems to be, if something's made in part to make money, or if money is being made around it, then it can't possibly do that other thing. Why should we think that? I mean, you know, look, someone who goes into nursing or high school teaching will get paid, but they're not doing it for the money. And there's plenty of people who, like Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. It wasn't just so he could buy himself a Porsche. You know, that's not why Spike Lee made that movie.
You want to take that one, Adrian?
Well, I think it just because something is... Just because there's something that exceeds, value creation, doesn't change the fact that the people behind something like Do the Right Thing obviously were doing it to make money. The people who were giving Spike Lee the money were not in it.
Right.
Absolutely.
But
that's
it was a mere commodity. See, art may have been a commodity, commodified to some extent in the Middle Ages. I don't really think that's quite true. But in the capitalist system, it's just a commodity. Right. Only the demands of
I hear you saying
commerce,
that, but I don't hear you making an argument.
Well,
for it,
right? We got a whole show. We got to take to a break. So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about Adorno and the culture industry with Adrian Daub from Stanford University.
In our next segment, we'll think about the corruption of culture by money. Are movies and music bound to be debased by the demands of commercialism, or can they still be great works of art?
Culture, commodification, and corruption, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Does the culture industry, or what Joni Mitchell calls the star maker machinery, suck the life out of artists and spit them back out as vapid rock and roll stars? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about the culture industry. Our guest is Adrian Daub from Stanford University.
So, Adrian, here's a quote from Adorno. Movies and radio need no longer pretend to be art. They are just business. Is that really true?
I think it is. I think that, you know, in the age of box office reports that somehow tell people what movies to watch, we've really cut out the middleman. No one's saying, which they should say, Black Panther is a terrific movie, you should see it. They're saying it's the number one movie, it's breaking all these box office records, therefore go see it.
I mean, what do you mean no one's saying that? Reviewers say that. So,
well,
yes,
reviewers
of course,
say all kinds of things.
Right, but I mean, the reviewers don't say go see it because it's making a lot of money. They say go see it because it does this, it does that. It's, you know, and it, this
do you
is
know
a,
what makes a reviewer a successful, influential reviewer? It's a little bit less with Rotten Tomatoes, but in the old days, how many marquees they got on, right? How many times they got quoted on the marquee of a movie theater? They are servants of the capitalist industry.
Look, I mean, again, so it comes back to this, the same point, right? Yes, money is involved, and money is going to have perhaps some distorting impacts around the edges, but it doesn't mean that everything is completely driven by money. These reviews, look, A.O. Scott, writing in the New York Times, isn't thinking, how can I make more money writing these reviews? He's trying to think, is this movie a good movie? How can I explain what's good about it?
His reviews are a commodity to the New York Times.
Fine.
The more clicks they get on his reviews, the more influence he gets. The more influence he gets, the more he's quoted on the movie marquee.
Okay,
it's
but bottom line, are you really saying you never learn anything real from a review?
I don't know, Adrian. What do you think?
Well, no, I think you do. But the problem, I think, becomes that, you know, Adorno has this very nice quote about how you can see the pudding mixed through the pudding and the culture industry. You look at a work of art, and one of the first mysteries you encounter is how did this get made? Why did this get made? And you sit there asking that very serious question. In the culture industry, you know exactly who made it, whether they were mad at each other when they made it, what the different personalities were like, how well it's doing, if it's a flop, if it's a hit. The fact that it's being produced for you is somehow becoming a feature of the object. I think that tends to probably distort what the object is like.
So, Josh, you sound like very optimistic. I want to test how optimistic you are. Are you denying that capitalism commodifies artistic production? Are you denying that at all?
No. I mean, it
commodifies it to a fare thee well. I mean, it's intensely driven by these cultural productions have to make us profit. If they don't make us profit, we don't support them. There may be some other way for it to eke out an independent cinema, but the big business of artistic production determines what gets produced by and large.
Well, so I mean, there's lots of things here, right? But the main point I just want to make is, yeah, sure, there's money involved, but that doesn't stop people making great art. Think about passion projects, right? So Scorsese has to make some big movie that makes money so that he can go back to the studio and say, you know what, now I want you to make a movie that loses money. And that's happening too. Now, movies are complicated because it takes a bunch of money to make a movie. But, you know, it's not that expensive to make a song. People are making all kinds of music. People are making all kinds of really countercultural, dissonant, innovative music.
Yeah, but would you say that those are more or less innovative once the culture industry gets its hands on it? I mean, do you think that any you know, raucous punk band has ever been really improved by having been put in touch with a massive record label?
I don't know. I mean, like, that would be an interesting thing to do an empirical test. Like, I think we all like to think a priori.
I don't think this is a priori. Let's think what happened to rap. Rap is world music now. I remember back in 2005, I was spending the summer in Australia and driving along and listening to rap on Australian radio. I said, wow, rap has really made it. It's world music now. My son, who loves original gangster rap, says, yeah, it's world music, but it sucks. And why does it suck? Because it's aimed at kind of the lowest common denominator, because the lifeblood has been sucked out of it by the demands of commodification and commercialization. And that's you can't deny that's a real phenomenon.
If you focus on the belated side of anything, you're going to find cases of commodification. But if you focus at the moment of its production, you're going to find innovation. And that production, that innovation, was real, and it was happening within this same system you guys keep complaining about.
Well, at the same time, I guess I keep trying to draw the contrast to sort of avant-garde art, right? Avant-garde art gets staid, gets uninteresting, gets incorporated, and someone does something even crazier, and suddenly that's avant-garde. I think I agree with Ken that basically the process is reversed in the culture industry. Something starts out being exciting, vibrant, extremely alive. And then the commerce sets in, and within 20 years,
what about the golden age of TV? What about TV now? Don't you see interesting things happening? I mean, Twin Peaks, even back in the day, that, again, was produced within the culture industry.
Right.
And yet, radically different. I mean, it defies all possible expectations. You expect that they're going to solve the mystery, and so on and so on and so on.
Right.
This is possible, too, right?
But at the same time, you know, I think that already we're looking at kind of a end of a golden era. And I think that we're looking at a moment when we're sort of noticing that even these very highly prestigious productions are starting to resemble each other, and that the kinds of things that we held up 10 or 15 years ago as being path breaking are now being copied 15 or 20 times on one Netflix channel.
Josh, I think you're underestimating the logic of capitalism. Capitalism is going to Adorno says something about uniformity, but he also talks about all the niches that capitalism provides for all the different kind of people to identify themselves as this, that, or the other thing. I think that too is part of the logic of capitalism.
You guys are just talking about the logic of art.
I want to let a caller in here, and we've got Starchild from San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Starchild.
Hi, thank you very much.
What's your comment or question?
Well, you know, I hear you guys talking about capitalism, and I think you may be misusing that term a little bit, or at least I'd like to kind of challenge you on that.
Okay.
I don't think capitalism is commodification. Commodification is one of the things you can choose to do with your freedom under capitalism. Capitalism is simply having the freedom to buy and sell. And what you choose to do with that freedom is up to you. You can live an aesthetic life and be like Mahatma Gandhi or something, or even, you know, live like you're...
Yeah, you. I think you're a star child. I think I'm going to push back on you. Because I think capitalism, Marx says in the Communist Manifesto, that capitalism has reduced every relation between human and human, he says, between man and man, to naked calculations of self-interest. Think about childcare. Who used to take care of your children? Like your grandmother, your wife, your neighbor, people who loved your children. Now you can do something. You can hire for wage labor a daycare worker to take care of your children. Your daycare worker doesn't have to love your children, right? So it's replaced a relation of love that's grounded in human connectivity and replaced it with an economic relation. That's turning it into a commodity, and that's what capitalism does. It commodifies more and more and more stuff, and capitalism has commodified artistic production. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, and of course, there's a. I think there's a certain degree of freedom in it, and I think your childcare example makes that clear. There is something nice about getting to choose, but there is this dark side to it that if everything is open to your choice, the inherent qualities of things suddenly become interchangeable.
Right.
I just feel like you can't have it both ways, right? About pop culture. You know, the main argument seems to be everything's the same. It's all, you know, completely ground down into similarity, monotony. But on the other hand, when I show you that it isn't all the same, you say, oh, well, that's niche marketing.
I think you got to do a little dialectical thinking here. No, but I think I don't agree with every word that Adorno says. Well, I couldn't possibly agree that every word Adorno says. I don't even understand every word he says because he writes obscurely, right?
Yeah.
But I think there is a deep point. I think the logic that produces much of what gets produced is the same, right? I don't think that every product is the same, because I think he kind of plays with this idea. He realizes, right, this thing about that you said in the opening about, well, there are films in which they're not going along and everything doesn't work out. Yes, but what happens in those films? Either the person gets crushed or something, right? So you gotta, human beings are complex and capitalism isn't blind to that complexity.
Look,
so it's got to provide lots of different kind of products.
Okay, but look, I think if you're willing to be a kind of Eeyore figure, it's easy to interpret anything to make it seem negative. But, you know, you've got to give better arguments than that. Just, well, you know, when things are going great, that's a celebration of capitalism. And when things are going badly, that makes you resign yourself. Look, I'm sorry, yeah, I could read anything that way. I could read all the things Adorno likes and make them seem terrible.
Really, you think that, you know, that there's something, I mean, a true sort of avant-garde. I know you love Beckett. You think that you could read Beckett as deeply affirmative?
No, but I could say, oh, that also makes us resign ourselves. Anything Adorno likes, like if I want to be like Adorno, of course, you can always make something seem like it's terrible and just makes you resign yourself or love the system or something like that. But these are just...
Go back to the hit.
Arguments
go
are arbitrary.
Go back to the very idea of a hit. A hit film, a hit song, right? And think of the vapid sameness of so much hit material. Here's something else that capitalism is about, according to like the Marxists, and even according to the honest capitalist. It's not just about the satisfaction of desires that are antecedently there. It's about the creation and disciplining of desires. And the very phenomena of the hit song, you know, the top 40 song, and then you can hardly tell the difference between the top 40 songs, is disciplining and creating taste, right? You don't agree with that?
So I think the question of disciplining taste is a really interesting one. But first of all, I don't agree that all songs are the same. I think, you know, this is a kind of aristocratic, snooty disdain that Adorno has for the, you know, us hoi polloi. But
you're not hoi polloi. You're a Brit intellectual. Cop lit guy.
But the other thing I want to say
is... Who writes about Proust?
True. Fair cop. But the other thing I want to say is, look, you know, you really think it's that different? You think that there was some golden age where... everything was just radically different from everything else. No, look, there's always been mediocre art. The vast majority of all cultural production is always going to be mediocre. That's just how it is.
Well, I mean, we should say that Adorno doesn't think there ever was a golden age. I mean, I guess we might disagree with that, but he doesn't think so. He thinks it's always been about power relations. It's just in capitalism, it becomes perfectly obvious, you know, much more so than it would have been in, let's say, a Gothic cathedral.
Right. So he's not harkening back to some past as
paradise
from which we have fallen. I mean, no Marxist would do that anyway.
No.
I mean, the history is a transition away from failed human relations to other human relations.
I think the sort of moments that you get where he is nostalgic is for a more dispersed mode of cultural production, right? Adorno was a composer himself, was an avid musician. He likes this idea of, you know, what happened when people were making the music themselves in their homes, et cetera. You know, I think that's sort of where he has a certain amount of nostalgia. He thinks that today, of course, there's a great concentration of the centers of production. And today we might say, well, with Amazon Direct Publishing, et cetera, with YouTube, anyone can do this. Well, that's not really true either. Some platforms are heavily concentrated, and for the rest of us, there is... podcasting, basically. Right.
Karen from Milpitas on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Karen. What's your comment or question?
Hi, I have a really quick question. So, given that money is involved, and I guess to an extent that I want to give money to artists so that they can live life in a way that may be different than mine, so that they can produce art that I can consume, that is, or that I can view and look at that is different than right. what I would experience in my own life? How can I do that without painting their art with any of my intentions?
There you go. You got an idea, Adrian?
I worry that maybe you can't, but maybe that's not the worst thing. You know that doesn't mean that the artist's work will get worse because of it. It just means that I think there's a certain naivete we can't have, right? We are in a capitalist system. That will influence the art that's being made. And I guess we'll have to live with that.
I think there's a profound question here, though, because one of the things, when Adorno was writing, for example, the production of the mass production of art was not very democratized.
Right.
You know, the big studio system, the big recording companies. I mean, there was the jazz movement right. arising, but he missed jazz. He didn't understand jazz.
Nope, not at all.
The stupidest things he says are
we agree
about
on
jazz.
This one. Yes. Oh, good. Good.
No, they're by far the stupidest things he says about jazz, about anything, the things he says about jazz. But you might think, well, maybe we've overcome the capitalist hegemony because of right. technology has democratized production and given us many new avenues to distribute stuff. All you need, I mean, is that great artist in his or her garage and the internet.
You can make a movie on your phone.
And CD and right. CD Baby. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something to that. At the same time, I keep thinking, I mean, I was very excited when these websites like Patreon and Kickstarter, right, sort of came on the scene. At the same time, I now notice that there are YouTube videos that explain to you exactly how to streamline your product so that it will maximize right. what you get there. And then I think, well, gee, if I were to argue with Adorno, that's probably what he'd point to.
Yeah, because Adorno thinks that the capitalist production of technology serves capitalism, and so all the technology that gets produced under capitalism gets repurposed for the purposes of the capitalist. And I think you see that happening with like Facebook and Google. They look like these great democratizing things, and what have they become? Huge behemoth.
But again, look, I think if you sat in your room and you thought to yourself, what kind of an art world would I want to see in the ideal case? You might think, well, I'd like to see a great variety of artworks. Some of them really protest against the system, and some of them are really dissonant, and some of them are innovative and unpredictable. Well, guess what? That's exactly what we have. So just to say,
except you're a highly educated, highly sophisticated consumer of these things, Josh. But here's the thing I don't think you're giving enough credit for. Take the average person under capitalism, I don't know who that is, but take some mythical average person under capitalism and ask them to imagine what they want to see. And you know what? I bet they're going to basically want to see what capitalism gives them to see, because capitalism already on its own, it conditions our taste. Our imaginations are not just free, unfettered things. They are conditioned by capitalism.
I think
Do you
that's
agree
right.
or disagree
yes,
with that?
Yes, but it's the case with any society. So our people's tastes are going to get conditioned by their society,
How can you have a society, how can you have a social, economic, political formation that frees the imagination to have full range of human possibilities? How can you do that, Adrian?
Yeah, I think that's where Adorno's background as a Marxist philosopher becomes super important, right? Earlier you said, you sort of suggested that there's something elitist about Adorno, and that's in some strict sense probably true. But his point is not that most people are stupid and like stupid things. His point is that people are not given the time. Of course, if you come home at 8 p.m. from a long day of work, you're going to go for, Leave It to Beaver over a Mondrian painting. The point that he wants to make is maybe we need to strive for a society where everybody can spend time with the kind of art represented by a Mondrian painting.
Yes, you're listening to Philosophy Dog. We're asking about the culture industry with Adrian Daub from Stanford University.
In our final segment, we'll think about what you can do if you're worried about culture getting ruined by commodification. How can we resist what's being fed to us by the culture industry and find the real works of art wherever they may be?
A critique of capitalist judgment when Philosophy Talk continues. This song is just another capitalist commodity constructed to conform to crass commercialism, or so Adorno would say, and he'd probably be right. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and our guest is Adrian Daub from Stanford University. Today, we're thinking about the culture industry.
And we've got a caller on the line, Rob in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rob. What's your comment or question?
Yes, good morning. First of all, very, very engaging and interesting conversation this morning. I would just ask that the panel consider the question whether or not art has always been commodified well before capitalism. And I offer that early art was created for a multitude of reasons as a commodity to please the church, to please the people in power, and or simply just to increase the prominence of the artist within their own art medium's peer group.
Josh here is doing cartwheels of joy because you're echoing a point he made earlier in the show, Rob. So Josh would surely agree with you.
I think you're a very brilliant person.
Yes. So thanks for
made a new best friend.
Thanks for the question, Rob. Okay. We had this before, but I want to give you another chance to just knock Josh out of the park.
Oh, jeez.
I know you guys are colleagues and friends.
Yeah,
right?
I gotta be gentle here. I agreed to a point. If the point is that people have always tried to make money or survive making art, that's certainly been true for a long time. At the same time, I do think that, again, if we go back to a Gothic cathedral, it doesn't have a price tag, right?
It
doesn't. A Greek temple doesn't have a price tag. It's not, there's an economic aspect to it. I don't think you call it commodified.
Did the paintings in the Sistine Chapel before the rise of capitalism, were there reproductions of those and they got sold and the demand? Was there a whole business of reproducing these things and?
Only starting in the 18th century, right?
Right. So that's post-capitalist, right? Yeah. So I mean, in the Middle Ages, an art, you created a piece of art. Some patron paid you to make a piece of art. It hung somewhere, I assume. Did people have to pay to see this thing?
Well, or it was part of a ritual context, right? I mean,
right.
And there were certainly things you weren't allowed to copy, right? Today, everything, right? Any painting can be on any mug. The little finger of Saint Cecilia. I think you're pretty much not supposed to copy that.
That whole commodification thing as a thing that more units of it can be produced, more viewers means more money. I mean, when did more viewers of a, well, I suppose in Shakespeare's time, more viewers of a play meant more money. But
I think, look, I sort of take your point, but I think you guys are focusing selectively. So, I mean, look, yeah, not everything was like churches. You also had bands of sort of touring performers
who would get paid right away, after the show.
Who
were disreputable folks, right?
Right, okay, so you had that. And conversely, today you have situations, like many people are listening to their popular music on YouTube today.
Yeah.
And as far as they're concerned, it's free. Now, of course, we can get into whether it really is free. But as far as they're concerned, they do something that they're not paying for. They hear a song. All they're focused on is how much they love the song.
In terms of commodification, I would just throw in one thing, right? Let's say one of those medieval troops shows up in your village and does their play. You can give them the money, you cannot give them the money. You cannot say, oh, there's this other troupe that also happens to be in town and I will put my money there. That's
why
the point of commodification.
Why is that worse?
No, it's not worse, but that's what commodification is.
It's not worse. It's just the logic of capitalism. And the point, so you're going to grant the logic of capitalism, right? But then the point of the Adorno point, I mean, there's a lot in Adorno that I don't understand or don't agree with, but the sort of basic Marxist critique of capitalist production. When the capitalist mode of production meets artistic production, a complicated thing happens. It's hard to deny that. Right, it's a new way of producing art under the sun that wasn't before. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that and it's hard for us to even imagine and conceive of art the way it used to be, I guess.
Right, but again, I want to ask you a question about. So I said capitalism creates conditions and disciplines taste. So is it even possible? Are we totally powerless before this capitalist machinery of taste production, manipulation, and discipline? Can we stand up and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm not going to consume this anymore. Is that even possible, do you think?
I think that there are ways of doing that. And I hope that and I think that actually Adorno has some suggestions there too. And I sort of thought of three things that I think he points to. One is we just can't be naive consumers, right? What we happen to want cannot be something that we think just occurred to us. It's been produced in us, and that's okay, but it's something to take into account. Second thing, he dwells very much on this question of categorization, of judgment, the fact that things are pre-categorized. If you're this kind of person, you might also enjoy this other thing. break that. Get out of that mold, I think, is very important. And the third one is own your Philistinism. Don't let the culture industry tell you sort of what kind of expertise you need to have. If you think a play is over your head, go see it twice anyway. And if you still don't get it, that's fine too. It's probably better than reading the little booklet that explains everything and pre-digests everything for you.
Yeah, I love all of those things. I just want to say one quick thing, which is Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison started writing the book she wrote because they didn't exist. She had an idea of the book she wanted to read. They didn't exist, so she made them. Right. And so to me, that shows...
Well, working at a publishing house is true.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that shows, on the one hand, that capitalism wasn't doing all it could have. But on the other hand, we aren't just drones. We aren't just complete servants to the system. It's possible for a great individual like Toni Morrison to say, you know, there's something that needs to be done, not so I can make money. It needs to be there, and I'm going to make it.
Look, I agree with something underneath you. I think the human impulse to create, human genius, human imagination, is not totally a prisoner of the moment. Right. I totally agree with that. And that's why revolutionary change and revolutionary imagination is possible. But it's still, there is the brute, to use an existentialist term, there is the brute facticity of the capitalist mode of production, which is not just something I can say, forget that.
Right.
That's the air against which your wings have to beat in order to achieve this elevation from it. And I think it's a huge and massive fact.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I think that there's there's really a call here for being open to aesthetic experiences, but also being really scared of moments when your aesthetic experience is kind of predetermined. When you're sort of being told. What you're being given and how you are to receive it.
So this almost sounds like a beautiful dialectical moment, if I may say, right? You know, we could say, well, we're not completely entrapped.
Right.
But it's good to be aware of the particular constraints operating now so that we can try to push back against them the way that Adrian was saying.
Right. So we got a comment just along these lines that asks, I think we kind of answered this, but let's just foreground it. How can you have a society, this is from Joanne, how can you have a society that's free thinking about art and culture without commodification? You can't. The herd mentality is hardwired, and that tendency lends itself to commodification.
That's interesting.
Interesting. I wonder, at the same time, so is the drive to distinguish ourselves from others.
Right.
I mean, capitalism is great because it or works so well because it can do both.
So look, Adorno's a Marxist, right? He's a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist. That's fair reading, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I don't know what he thinks about the Soviet Union or China or any of those places.
Doesn't like them.
Doesn't like them. So here's the thing, right? I mean, it's hard for me, going back to Joanne's question. I think, how could we build a society, a social world, an economic, social, political world that gave free rein to the human imagination, right, and to produce things how does he put it in that quote? It's something like a world that's, you know, imagine possibilities different from this rapacious world. How do we make that happen? Because it seems to me there needs to be social enabling possibilities. Do you have a view? You guys both study high art and high culture. how do you enable that?
Yeah, I think that Adorno, this is the point where Adorno might indeed be kind of an elitist, because I think he thinks that if we give people this kind of freedom, they will gravitate towards harder, more difficult things. And then we might say, geez, you know, do we really think that we're all going to listen to Arnold Schoenberg the moment, you know, capitalism crumbles? Maybe we're not going to grand Adorno that.
I just think of amazing stories. Think of amazing stories in fiction. I think there are a zillion stories to be told. A few of them get told in movie making. And I do think that we're at a bit of a, like, if not a golden age, a bronze age of television and storytelling, like a Game of Thrones
The Wire?
The Breaking Bad. I think those are amazing storytelling. Yeah. Right? How can there be more of that?
Well, I do think that this decentralization probably is going in that direction. I hope that people getting easier and easier access to the means of production probably is one thing that Adorno would point to. At the same time, we can't allow it to sort of fracture us too much, right? Because a big part of great art is that it's compelling to a great number of people.
Right. So, Adrian, on that hopeful, possibly note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. I do not feel commodified by this conversation.
Oh, I'm very glad I've done my job.
Okay. Our guest has been Adrian Daub, a professor of German and comp lit at Stanford University, colleagues with Josh in the comp lit department, and co-author of The James Bond Songs, Pop Anthems of Late Capitalism. So, Josh, are you feeling liberated or commodified by today's conversation?
Always liberated. You know, I mean, obviously, product placement is terrible. The rash of sequels, that's lame. But, you know, they've always been constraints. It's always been possible to rise above them and make great works of art. And guess what? Today, a higher percent of the population gets to experience those works of art. All, you know, I mean, if it weren't for all the sort of industrialization and mass marketing and so on, people wouldn't be able to get their hands on a Toni Morrison novel for $15.
Yeah,
this is a good thing.
Mass marketing has its stuff. It does appeal to the masses. It does spread the goods of culture wider. And there have always been constraints, but there haven't always been the constraints of capitalism and capitalist commodification. And commodification is a good thing. It does give you access to paid child care and people to drive your car and all who don't care about you. It does do that. But it also has its downside. I just don't think you're alive enough to the downside of capitalist commodification for artistic production. But you know what? This conversation continues at our website, at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to Descartes, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog. Now a man who speaks so fast the culture industry will never catch him, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes. So 2018 saw the fall of the once mighty empire known as Toys R Us, gone into bankruptcy thanks largely to a $2 billion debt load acquired, as I understand it, back in 2005 or so, when the chain was purchased in a leveraged buyout. The way that works, apparently, is that Toys R Us wound up owning the debt the purchaser spent buying the store in the first place. This whole late capitalism shtick baffles me. It's like selling your garage, only you still own it, and you have to pay cars to park in you. This makes no sense to me. So now the kiddies and collectors have to buy all their Star Wars robots at Walmart until Walmart collapses under its own weight. However will we survive? Whither the kitsch of tomorrow? All of this made me think of Adorno and Horkheimer's culture-industry concept. The idea is that mass culture and mass entertainment have replaced both high and low art, keeping us passive and enthralled to capitalism. They pointed to the film industry in particular, writing in Hollywood, ironically enough, in exile in the 1940s. So I guess they were talking about musicals and propaganda, but not film noir, a glum expressionist genre of the 1940s, which kind of undermines their point. They forgot that culture is subject to the same ever-changing whims of capitalism and desire as anything else that costs a buck. My favorite example is the movie V for Vendetta, based on the comic book written by the Brit Alan Moore, which he intended to be about the struggle between anarchy and fascism, with anarchy winning, kind of, spoiler alert, thanks to a masked superhero anarchist. The movie was a bit more Hollywood-y, but still weird, with the main character wearing his hero mask through the whole movie, as he kills off the fascists who wronged him one by one. It was kind of like Count of Monte Cristo, only creepy and dystopian. But okay, the mask design for the character was of Guy Fawkes, the English Catholic who tried to blow up King James in 1604. The movie became something of a cult hit, especially with anarchists, or their pale and pudgy young male stand-ins who troll the internet for grins, and the mask became popular at real-life protest marches and for some time was the top-selling mask on Amazon, selling hundreds of thousands a year. So every time an anarchist bought one of those masks, he was putting money into the pockets of Time Warner, a major corporation which made the movie, which is kind of ironic. Alan Moore himself, perhaps aware of this irony, hated the movie. He wrote, quote, "It's a thwarted and frustrated and largely impotent American liberal fantasy of someone with American liberal values standing up against a state run by neoconservatives," unquote. As opposed to his fantasy, I guess, of a lone English anarchist standing up to a fascist regime. Culture changes. The ironies get lost. Remember when Apple was the cool upstart and not just another damn culture-shocking behemoth? Remember Palm Pilots and Razors and Nokias and Blackberries? Now here's a thought experiment. Back in the early 1920s, say, a family in Kentucky at the birth of radio started a family band. They played ocarinas. They made themselves out of beets and a red clay glaze. They became big stars. To emulate them, people began making their own ocarinas. Beet sales went through the roof. Then the family began recording and marketing their own ocarinas made from Bakelite with the name of the family and a logo on the side. Ocarina making skills vanished. Beet carving dried up. Beet sales plummeted. And then people got sick of the ocarina family, the divorce, the troubled son, the trip to Hollywood that didn't quite work out. People got bored of it. Plus, they were into kazoos now and Hawaiian guitars. Then the Depression made it illegal to use beats for crafts. People were starving, so now nobody plays the ocarina, and most people hate beats. Is pop culture to blame, or cultural Marxism? And what about The Legend of Zelda, The Ocarina of Time? Remember that video game, 1998? There was a resurgence of interest in ocarinas. I think you could buy them at Toys R Us. Go to your iPad to check availability. Do they still have those? If not, I feel your pain. Speaking on behalf of culture everywhere, I am sorry for your loss. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Murrow Kessler, Carola Kreitmeyer, Emily King, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Verily, this vicious swaz of verbiage veers most verbose. So let me simply add that it's my very good honor to meet you, and you may call me V.
Are you like a crazy person?
I'm quite sure they will say so.